Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Propulsion Swimming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott, and back with me, as always, is my good friend, Dan. And on this week's show, we are talking to our first guest of 2023.
Yeah, hey, everyone. Hope you're all well and off to a great start to the new year. We've got ourselves a brilliant guest this week, a swimmer who's recently retired and forced to retire after having a terrible long-standing wrist injury, but has committed to staying involved in the sport by taking up a head coach role, which is, I think, fantastic news.
Yes, definitely. So on this week's podcast, we are talking to the one and only Alice Thomas. So let's have a listen for what's in store on this week's podcast.
So yeah, I had the second surgery. That ended up failing also. And 2 years later, they ended up saying, we're going to have to just manage this with cortisone injections, steroid injections to manage the inflammation and pain. But that was my management strategy then for the next 6 years. I've always considered myself quite a technical swimmer, so I'm really about technique and efficiency and things like that, and I've been quite particular about it. And we probably increased the amount of video analysis we would do in a session just to make sure that my hand position wasn't being affected by how my wrist was. So we would find that on fly, sometimes my bad hand would like slip out a bit more and I wouldn't hold as much catch if it was like having a bad day or whatever, if it was flaring up. Like, say I'm going 100% into a wall and a finish in training, it would start impacting the left arm and I'd get problems in my left elbow because I'm putting all of my force and weight on my left arm because I'm pulling that right arm away. Yeah. So it's not...
A domino effect all around.
Yeah, it's not just the problem is just in the wrist. If the problem is somewhere for a long time, you're going to start getting compensatory issues somewhere else.
So Alice was, of course, a Tokyo Olympian and has represented Wales with distinction at Commonwealth Games and was, in fact, Commonwealth champion in the 200 metres butterfly at the Gold Coast in 2018. Now, on this week's podcast, we are going to be talking with her a little bit more about that injury that forced her out of the sport. And when I say it's a bad injury, she has been told she's got the wrist of a 60-year-old with arthritis. So it really is going to be interesting to talk about how almost she lasted so long with the injury, Dan, and how she adapted her swimming and training to get to the Olympics in 2021, as well as Commonwealth champion, essentially with a wrist that was causing her a lot of pain.
Yeah, I'm very interested to see how she adapted her training, because I believe she got the injury first of all in 2010. So that's the best part of 10 plus years having to deal with this injury. I want to know how she dealt with it and how she had to adapt her training, because I imagine land training must have been extremely tough. So I'm really looking forward to this one.
Yeah, so as well as her injury, we are going to talk a little bit about transition out of the sport and her new coaching role and how she has hopefully had a little bit of a change in outlook on swimming after leaving the pool. So please welcome onto this week's Propulsion Swimming Podcast, Alice Thomas. So Alice, thank you for coming onto the podcast this week. How are things with you in cold Wales?
Yeah, always cold. They're good. They're ticking along nicely. Obviously a bit of a change from what I was doing this time last year, but yeah, all in all good.
Yeah, so as we said in our intro, you're now retired and not really through a choice of your own. So you've had an ongoing wrist injury, which has reached the point that you can no longer carry on training at an elite level. Can you kind of describe to our listeners exactly what the injury is and how bad it was / still is?
Yeah, so like you say, it's a wrist injury. Okay, long story short, I've had an ongoing wrist injury since 2010. So the onset began before my first Commonwealth Games in Delhi. And it started off as a very basic cartilage tear within what's called the TFCC. So it's like a triangle group of cartilage that's within the lumpy bit of your wrist that joins onto your hand. And they thought the mechanism of injury was through continuous loading, so like impact through fly turns on the wall, and it was just a basic cartilage tear, and I ended up having my first surgery to repair that, just keyhole surgery after the Delhi Commonwealth Games, fairly soon after that. That turned out to fail. I re-tore it, and then I had another surgery 2 years later in 2012, an open repair this time, in which they found some of my ligaments had subluxed. And I was losing a lot of stability within my wrist joint. I did say long story short. This is turning out to be a long story.
No, keep going.
But it is a long story at the end of the day. So yeah, I had the second surgery. That ended up failing also. And 2 years later, they ended up saying, we're going to have to just manage this with cortisone injections, steroid injections to manage the inflammation and pain. Because obviously I was still training at a high level, competed in Glasgow in my second Commonwealth Games, still with like, you know, trying to take my wrist to give it more stability and things like that, and the steroid injections on top. So, that was my management strategy then for the next 6 years, was taping, steroid injections, things like that. It then got to a point around kind of Olympic cycle where it became apparent that steroid injections was becoming less effective. The wrist was becoming more grumbly, more easily aggravated. The injections weren't becoming effective anymore. So it was sort of like, look, the health of your wrist, you can't keep putting these injections into your wrist. They're probably doing more harm than good. You're just going to have to try and manage your wrist more conservatively. So it literally was just the point of kind of things like paracetamol, Brufen, and meters of tape to try and give me some stability so that I had something to kind of pull in the water and to hit walls with. That was my management strategy going into Olympics and coming out the other side of it. It just got to the point last summer, sort of after Birmingham, that I had a consultation with a specialist who turned around to me and kind of said, look, this is the state of your wrist. You've got the arthritis of a 60-year-old. If you continue to load it and train on it at this level that you are, you could potentially lose function in your hand and wrist. And that was a bit of a like point of like, right, okay, I've continued so far on this wrist to this point where it is probably a point of no return if I were to carry on. And, you know, they do still want to potentially do some fairly serious surgeries, but they want to put that off for as long as possible. So I'm at the point where it's like, I've got to rest it, let it calm down. The level of aggravation from loading it for so long has got it to a point where it's just so niggly that I've got to back off. I've got to let it rest to see if I can just have like a normal lifestyle with it, because it was impacting me quite a lot.
I mean, I've got so many questions. Like, I've literally overloaded with questions in my head. Yeah, I know. Let's go with this one first. You've had the steroid injections. How often were you taking that? Was that a daily thing or a weekly thing?
So they were every 3 to 4 months.
Right, okay.
They would be quite, quite painful injections to have because it was a ferrule needle right into your wrist joint. And they'd be ultrasound guided. So like I'd watch the little needle on the screen go into my wrist and like get the point where I need to go. I'm a bit weird like that. I get really like, but I figure like this, like my wrist has caused me so many issues for so long. Like I want to know why. I want to see like, what is it? To the point. So they would be every 3 to 4 months and like I'd start feeling it wearing off and I'd sort of, you know, speak to coaches, speak to the doctors and be like, is it time? Do I need another? Has it been long enough? Sort of thing. And really grateful for the support team around me really to be able to manage all of it, to be honest.
When we think about swimming in kind of general, when you pitch it to parents, you almost say it's like a non-contact sport, it's a non-load bearing sport, and then the injury that you've got, you say arthritis of a 60-year-old.
That's crazy.
It's obviously the impacts was doing the damage. So how much adapting in your training did you have to do through that Olympic cycle to get to Tokyo?
Yeah, there was a lot, to be honest. And it started probably way back before Commie Games 2018, even. You know, like to be fair, the S&C coach and the physios I have around me, or I have had around me, I've been absolutely phenomenal in sorting out those alterations and things I've needed to change, especially on land, because the way I can and can't load in the gym is quite difficult. Like I have to change the positioning of my wrist and the positioning of my hand. But my S&C, Spencer, he's been so good at just like coming up with adaptations, coming up with alternative exercises that still target the same response or the same muscle group. And he just does it like in a blink of an eye. It's like, okay, if you can't do that, that's fine. Let's go off and do this. And it's never been too much bother for him. So yeah, you know, like simple things, quite a lot of overhead upper body movements have been pretty difficult. Anything where, like bench, for example, I couldn't use a normal bar. I had to use what's called a football bar. So instead of my hands being in this position, they'd be in this position. It just caused less loading and crunching on my wrist. And that bar was pretty useful in quite a lot of exercises where I could just change the positioning of my wrist, the angle that I was pulling or pushing. You know, I'd find I wouldn't be doing any press-ups or anything like that, anything loading on all four, and that would go over into things like pre-pull and post-pull. So any kind of like flows where we'd be on all fours, you know, upward, downward dog, I wouldn't be doing anything like that. Anything, any like kind of thread the needle where I'd be like leaning on my hand because I couldn't lean on my hand. I'd have to find alternatives for those. I did try like leaning on my knuckles and like make almost like leaning on my hand like a spider like this. But through quite a lot of years of leaning like that, I then caused a lot of stress in my thumb joint.
Yeah.
Which was actually quite a problem last year going into Birmingham. My thumb joint started really flaring up. Again, lots of tape around my thumb to give me stability, but tape was my only option at the end of it. There's just a lot in there to try and adapt.
So obviously it was a very painful injury and it probably still is now. On a scale of 1 to 10, how painful was it? Because I remember you telling us in Swansea at Welsh Winter Nationals that it got to a point in your home life that you couldn't even lift up the kettle to have a cup of tea or coffee. I mean, how can you describe the pain to us a little bit more?
Yeah, so it would get to that point where I couldn't lift up my cup of coffee, let alone the kettle, the pans, couldn't chop food, couldn't brush my hair, couldn't brush my teeth. I was like doing it with my left hand instead because it's my right hand, it's my dominant hand, so even things like just writing in general, I was all over the place. My writing was really bad. It would even be like just after a really hard session or a hard gym session, I would just be lying like sitting on the sofa or whatever and my wrist would just be aching, it would just be throbbing, and I couldn't get it I couldn't get my hand in a comfortable enough position to like stop it or to ease it. So I did have like, I think I went to like a specialist to get like braces molded for my hand for rest. So I had like this splint completely molded to my hand that I could just, it was a really bulky thing to be fair. And I've still got it and sometimes use it, but just put my whole hand in like a splint and just leave it there. And just be like, right, you go over there, you rest. But yeah, it did get quite painful at times, and I used to get quite like down about it, and quite why is this happening to me? Like that was sort of like the when I was feeling a bit much about it. But then the majority of the time, I was just like, well, let's crack on, let's get on with it. Like this is just everyone has their thing, right? Everyone has something, and this is just mine. This is just my something that I have to deal with.
A lot of what you've described right now is kind of out of the pool, so how it's really impacted almost the additions to swimming with the land training and pre-pool, which is really important, and then the day-to-day life. But how did it impact your stroke? Did you have to make distinct changes to what is, I presume at this point for your career to get to Tokyo, it's an entirely natural stroke. You're not thinking too much about where your hand placement is. Did that have to change?
Yeah, it was. It's quite interesting actually because I've always considered myself quite a technical swimmer, so I'm really about technique and efficiency and things like that, and I've been quite particular about it. And we probably increased the amount of video analysis we would do in a session just to make sure that my hand position wasn't being affected by how my wrist was. So we would find that on fly sometimes my bad hand would like slip out a bit more, and I wouldn't hold as much catch. If it was like having a bad day or whatever, if it was flaring up. So it was just trying to be more mindful of like, okay, wrist is feeling bad, just like slow down or back off a little bit and make sure that if it was a really intense session, just make sure that even though wrist might be painful, just make sure that's not impacting overall technique and your technique isn't suffering for that.
That must be hard when you're an elite athlete really just wanting to give 100% to every set you can.
Yeah, exactly. But then there's no point giving 100% to a set that isn't technically good. It was more about just checking in, okay, is that impacting too much? Because ultimately, and this is kind of what happened a bit towards the end of last season, or actually at the start a little bit, was if my catch wasn't being efficient and my catch started altering, it would impact further up my shoulder. So I ended up having quite a lot of shoulder issues toward like this time last year, kind of January, February time, because ultimately my wrist was bad and it was affecting how much pressure I could put through the catch, which was affecting how my shoulder was moving through my stroke. So my shoulder was taking more of the brunt instead of my wrist and how I was pulling. So it started to affect further up in my body, if you like. Because I wasn't having as effective pain management on my wrist at that point, because I could no longer have the injections. So that was something extra to think about and deal with as well.
Wow. And what about doing turns in training? Because that's obviously where the injury kind of occurred, if you like. Yeah. How did you deal with that?
So we thought long and hard. We had quite a lot of conversations about, okay, do I need to be doing turns, as many turns in training? Like, can I just put in a freestyle flip turn when I'm doing fly and things like that? Or do I need to change how I'm doing turns in general? Because the right hand is the hand I leave on the wall. It gets most of the impact, and my left hand is the one I pull away to turn. Like, do we look at changing that? And we, after all the discussions, we were like, no, don't change anything, because ultimately the more you change, the more that's going to impact over into your racing. You need to practice every day in training what you want to put into a race. So we didn't change anything to do with my turns. Again, sometimes on a bad wrist day, it would change how I was finishing. I would tend to pull away my bad hand on a finish. And sometimes, like say I'm going 100% into a wall on a finish in training, it would start impacting the left arm and I'd get problems in my left elbow because I'm putting all of my force and weight on my left arm because I'm pulling that right arm away. Yeah. So it's not
a domino effect all around.
Yeah, it's not just the problem is just in the wrist. If the problem is somewhere for a long time, you're going to start getting compensatory issues somewhere else. But we sort of knew how to treat, because we couldn't effectively treat the wrist, we knew it was long term. We had to learn how to effectively treat the other things that would flare up along the way. So like we knew, okay, elbow's flaring up, we know what to do with that. Shoulder's flaring up, okay, yeah, this is our go-to. So yeah, it wasn't as straightforward as like isolate the wrist, we know what to do. It was like think about the compensatory things that also go along with it.
Wow. So much work behind the scenes, I think, to I don't know, it seems like the whole training schedule, not changed, but had to be fully adapted, like from everything.
Yeah.
Crazy. That's amazing.
It slowly adapted, though. It wasn't like, oh, okay, bad wrist in 2010, this is our new adapted program. It like slowly molded along the way because, you know, like when I first had the injury in 2010, if you told me that it would be, you know, 12 years later and you'd have an even worse wrist and you'd end up having to retire from the sport because of it. Like, blow my mind. I would not believe you.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah.
So.
Are you still able to get in the pool recreationally?
I think I can, yeah. But have I? No.
Oh, right. Okay. Is there a reason you haven't? Because obviously you're dealt with this massive blow that your career's essentially over, is taken out of your hands.
Yeah.
How hard was that to almost transition out, like, as a mental hurdle to get over, that you're not able to train every day anymore? Is that the reason you've not got back in, just because you need a clean break?
I think potentially, I think, like you say, it's hard when it's taken out of your hands, the decision's taken away from me, and I feel almost like, I don't know if bitter is the right word, but it's almost like, why would I get back in if I can't do it the way I want to? Like, if I'm not allowed to train competitively and race competitively, like on international world stage, which is kind of where I was at, like, why would I want to just get in and plod up and down? because wrist is still going to hurt me if I'm doing that. And it's kind of worth it if I'm still able to be there on the international stage. That was my mindset anyway. I can put up with that if the payoff is that I'm still able to be the best I can be or get the most out of myself, challenge myself day in, day out. But I think that's my mindset at the moment. And it might be a very, I don't know, very insular type of mindset and not very like outwardly thinking or selfish or I don't know. But like, I think it's just because of I feel like it's not been my decision to stop. Therefore, it's like I'm not saying I'm never going to get back in. I really miss being in the water, but I need to find my way of being in the water. I think because it's still fairly early.
Yeah,
at the moment, 100%. The month, yeah. Like I need to kind of find my way back rather than just like, oh, I'm just going to go in public swim. In the pool, used to train in. Do you know what I mean? Like it's didn't quite feel right.
Yeah, because I had a somewhat similar scenario because I got appendicitis, which then wiped me out completely. And I was doing similar sort of training to you, let's say, for example, 20 hours in the pool, whatever. Yeah. And I just found it such a mental obstacle to get over because it was such a regimented routine. You have lunch at 1 o'clock. And I still, after like months after being forced out, every time 1 o'clock came round, I was like, I'm hungry. I need to go and eat. And and I have lunch. And I suppose it kind of is, if you put it like that. I suppose it's weird. Have you managed to get over it at all in any sort of way? I know it's early days still, but.
I was talking about this too. I had a meeting this morning with Performance Lifestyle. And I was saying about, I miss the simplicity of having a routine planned for you. Like as an elite athlete, you don't have to think about your week, your structure. Like it's all planned there, ready for you. You don't have to think, oh, I've got a meeting tomorrow and then an email pops up and the time's changed and oh no, it's moved to Thursday. Like you don't have to think about those things. Everything is all planned for you. Your week is done. You just have to turn up and do the session. Like it's all there. It's all done. Like your rest times are there. Like you say, your lunch and dinner is planned. Like the times that you're eating. Like it's all ready for you. Just, do you know what I mean? Like, and there's simplicity in that. And everything gets a little bit more complicated when you don't have that structure. Like you have to kind of create it. And there's like complications in freedom, I think.
Too much choice.
Too much choice, exactly. Like, yeah. As nice as it is a little bit, like then you're like, actually, do you know what, I need a bit of structure here.
And did swim whales help you with that transition period and almost give you a structure outside of swimming, or were you just left to your own devices?
To be fair, they've been super supportive with me. They're helping me in like my new kind of career path at the moment with coaching. They've been really supportive in helping me with that and, you know, getting me on level one, level two courses. And, you know, still keeping me in touch with like physio, Performance Lifestyle, psych, you know, I'm having quite regular meetings with that just to keep me everything in check. And, I'm still popping on poolside with my old squad and like lending a hand and things, getting in the way. And I find it fun. I think some of the other guys appreciate it as well, just to have me about. And so I'm creating structure with that at the moment. It's good.
Yeah. I mean, that there is a clear problem of when an athlete finishes their career and then they suddenly go from 20, 25 hours of workouts to then suddenly zero almost overnight. What would you like to see in the future for athletes transitioning out of the sport? Should there be some sort of pathway, do you reckon?
I think it's difficult because obviously the majority of people choose when they've had their time and they kind of maybe also have an idea of where they want to go. But I do also think that actually when faced with that decision, what they think they want to do and what they actually end up doing are very different things. So I don't know, I think there would also be a good kind of idea around prepping more people just to say, look, okay, you don't want to be stuck in the position of like, okay, what now? Like that blank response. And the problem is like I was in that position as well of like, you don't want to focus on anything else but swimming when you're in that elite bubble because you don't want to take your attention off anything else, because I was sort of in that, because I'd done my degree, graduated and everything else, but then I was just full-time swimming. And I didn't want to think about, oh, what after swimming? What am I going to do after? Like, is there anything else, like any other little courses or anything that can just set me up for, like, in the middle before I actually think about career or anything else? I didn't want to think about anything like that because I didn't want my attention to come off. And I just wonder if there's, like, anything, like, even if it's, like, getting more swimmers into coaching or teaching, because those are really easy things that they can pass their skills on, they can pick up a bit of a pay packet, they can just stay within the sport as well before transitioning completely away and going cold turkey. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I feel like there might be something in there that might just help.
Yeah, like you said, you are now coaching, which you said is kind of helping with that transition period.
Yeah.
Why coaching? Not just simply it's the easiest career path out of swimming, but why have you chosen to take up that career?
I think for me, like, I feel like I've got so much experience and I've been swimming for so long that I've just felt like my time in the sport is that, like, that can't just be it. I can't just walk away. Like, I can't just leave it and be like, oh, okay, yeah, someone told me to stop, I'm just going to leave the sport. And I feel like I want to use all of the experience and knowledge that I've gained, especially as being an older female that's taken a bit longer to kind of get onto the international stage. I feel like there's value in that, in trying to give back to a younger generation and trying to kind of, I want to kind of motivate and inspire others. And I think, like, coaching is a way to do that, right? It's a pathway to the younger generation that are trying to get through now. And I don't know, there was a bit of me as well that as I was getting older within the sport, I wanted more input with my own programming and my own sessions. And I felt like I began to understand a bit more about coaching and programming and what goes into a session. So I felt like it would be almost like a natural progression to try and to start and get more of an understanding about it. So, yeah, it's not necessarily just because it's the easiest thing. I don't think it's easy by any means.
No. Where are you coaching right now, by the way?
So I've literally just started last week. I started a job with Almond Valley, which is a small club in Carmarthenshire. So that's quite exciting. But, yeah, literally just started.
Did the kids recognise you and, you know, they know who you are and what you've achieved in the sport? Do they look at you as like a role model, like, oh my God, like Alice Thomas is now our coach. Oh, it's going to be amazing. That sort of feeling.
I think some of them do. And then some of them don't because they are quite young. So I was thinking about it. If they're like 9 years old, they won't have been old enough to have seen Gold Coast. Yeah. And that's kind of where I kind of came through and I had my best performances. So, and you know, I don't really mind if they know me or not. That's not why I'm there. But yeah, I do find it interesting. Like, some of the questions I get asked are just quite funny, and because they see like my Olympic rings tattoo on my arm, and they're like, "Oh, did you go to the Olympics?" And I'm like, "Yeah." Well, did you swim? And I tell them, and then they're like, "How much money did you win?" And I'm like, "No."
Money, swimming.
Not money. It's funny.
You say you keep popping back in on your old club Swansea. So how helpful have Adam and Stuart been in kind of guiding your career, and what tips have they given you for your new adventure that started last week?
Yeah, no, they've been really helpful actually, and they've been really good at like allowing me on poolside and like giving me different jobs to do, teaching me how to use a stopwatch and things like that. It's more complex than I thought. So like little things like that. They've been pretty good, and obviously I've been working with Stu for about 12-13 years, something like that, since I moved to Swansea. So I think he's sort of taken me under his wing a little bit, and like this is sort of our next stage is sort of like teaching me, if you like, which has been quite nice. And he actually let me write the squad a session a couple of weeks ago, which was quite fun. So like just he's given me a little bit, you know, to try and he's trying to teach me sort of stuff and giving me like experience at that level, as well as obviously at club level where I'm getting my own kind of learning done. So yeah, they've been pretty good, and like I enjoy it. I don't know whether I'm getting in the way, like I said, but it's good.
There's so much stuff that goes behind the scenes, because when we were there at Welsh Nationals, Welsh Winter Nationals, they were in the middle of doing the next cycle up until Champs, and the detail it goes into for the sprinters, for the distance swimmers, is quite incredible. And is that the sort of stuff you're really hoping to learn? And, or you probably already know half of it, to be fair, being a swimmer.
Yeah.
But is that something that you're aiming to now get to?
Yeah, I think so. Why not? Like, that's what I've been surrounded by for the last 12 years or so. So, like, I've got an athlete's understanding of what goes on, right? So like, I know what goes on from what I see and from what I read on the paper and from what I experience. But I find it really interesting that I'm now seeing the other side of it. So like you said, the planning and like the meticulousness that goes in behind it, and all the numbers and all of the, you know, the stats and stuff, and like how much really goes on behind the scenes. So like, that's what I'm finding really interesting, is like I keep saying to people, it's like a whole new perspective on things, because it's essentially the same stuff that I'm learning. Like, I already know it, but I'm just learning it in a new way. And that's the stuff that I'm finding really interesting. It's good.
Does that new perspective give you, is it able to give you a new outlook on reflecting back on your own career? Do you look back at any of your achievements differently now that you've got that coach's kind of mindset?
I don't know if I've managed to look back any differently yet, because I haven't really looked back too much, because I think I'm still kind of almost a bit sad when I look back, because it's still a bit like, oh, I won't be doing that again, or I won't get that chance to stand on the blocks in front of a crowd, or like feel those feelings again, like being able to compete and race and swim fast, like all that stuff. I still feel really proud of being able to have achieved all of these things, and like especially with the risk that I have and all of the challenges I guess I've faced, if you want to put it like that. But yeah, I guess like with hopefully the more I learn as a coach and the more I kind of learn along the way and experience, then perhaps, yeah, I might kind of see things in a different light, and perhaps I might, that's growth, isn't it? That's personal growth. So perhaps I'd like to think that I might reflect on perhaps some experiences I've had and think, oh, okay, well, perhaps that's why that happened, or that's why Stu and I butt heads quite a lot and kind of disagreed a little bit, and that's actually his perspective and that's why he was doing that, do you know what I mean, instead of just being frustrated all the time and things like that. So yeah, hopefully that
we'll ask you in like 2-3 years time
and I'll still be like, nah.
Stu was wrong all along. Maybe we should take a little bit of a delve into your career then for the first time, if you haven't reflected as properly. What were your best memories from swimming in general?
It's got to be Olympics, and Gold Coast are probably my two highlights. Yeah, it's fairly straightforward, isn't it? I think they're going to be my highlights. Gold Coast was just like mad, to be honest. It was just such a like, it was a blur, and then just a wave of like madness afterwards. And it was like everything I ever would have dreamed of being able to achieve. Like this, my 200 fly swim, the time, the games record, like everything all in one. That was amazing. And my family were out there as well. So to be able to celebrate with them a little bit was so good. And that was like a little special memory I'll always have, I think. And
to put it into perspective for our listeners, it was a gold at 200 fly, Gold Coast, a 205.45, which was over a 2 second PB.
Yeah.
If I'm correct. At games at the age of 27, which it's almost unheard of at elite level for that sort of drop to come. So that is how good a swim that was.
Yeah.
I remember watching it. the underwaters that you had off every turn, especially the last one, my God, I was like, oh my, what is happening here? And then to go, 2 second PB, it's just massive. Like, I don't, it's not supposed to happen. Like, was it a surprise?
The overall time was, but I knew I was swimming well because I think we'd done an open meet in Edinburgh leading up, and I'd swam a 207 unrested. And that was in, was that when there was Beast from the East there? So we were trudging through snow to get there, and I'd swam a 207 like in the heats as well, and then I'd done another one. I don't know. It was just, it was all, like, when you look back, you know, when you see things, you're like, oh, it was all coming together. Like, things were locking into place. But yeah, I think Stu said he didn't expect a 205. Like, he expected maybe a 6, but not a 5. The interesting thing about the underwater kicks, everybody always says about, oh, your kicks were amazing on the underwater. I'd had an arm injury the season before. I'd had bone stress in my humerus and my left arm, which meant I couldn't pull for 6 months. I was on kick only sessions. And so I improved my underwater kick because I'd only done kick. So I saw it as like an opportunity. I was like, right, let's work on something I can
definitely
do.
Worked.
And yeah.
I think that's a lesson for all those kids out there. Do kick.
Yeah.
I think a really interesting place to kind of end this conversation would be kind of around hitting that PB so late on in kind of your swimming career. So what would be your advice to those swimmers who are still kind of trying to reach that first international podium or personal bests, even when they're still going at the elite scene in their late 20s?
Yeah, no, I think it is a really interesting one, and it's something I spoke a lot about kind of immediately after Gold Coast, was just the fact that it's like a traditional thing that has always been drummed in, that you have to kind of, to be good or successful in swimming, you kind of have to have already peaked by the time you're in your teenage years, kind of that middle kind of 15, 16, especially if you're a female anyway. And I wasn't particularly very good when I was a young teenager. I was kind of average. I made nationals, maybe some finals, but I definitely didn't medal. And I think I kept going because I enjoyed it. I enjoyed swimming. I enjoyed training. I had a good group of friends. And I just carried on swimming because I enjoyed it. And I think as long as you keep enjoying it, there's no knowing when you're going to break through. So don't put pressure on yourself to think, oh, I have to be good this year, or I have to PB this year in order to be successful. Because I went years without making a PB, without dropping time. And I think that's actually the norm for quite a lot of people when they go through their growth spurts, or, you know, when you go off to a new school or off to a university. Like, when your environment changes, don't expect, like, to suddenly improve. Like, it doesn't work straight away. Like, you have to give it time, you have to be patient, and as long as you are still enjoying your sport, there's no reason why your breakthrough or your peak can't come later.
100%. To me, anyway. I think that's a really good place to kind of round up the interview portion of this podcast. We do, however, usually finish with some quick fire questions for our elite guests.
Okay.
Does that sound good to you?
Yeah, go for it.
So what was your favourite event?
It's going to be Two Fly.
Who was your swimming idol?
Ian Thorpe.
What's your proudest moment in swimming?
My Commonwealth Games 200 fly 2018.
What's the hardest set you've ever done in training?
There's any 200 fly pace set that was over 3k.
My God. Love it.
And final question, if you were to go on a road trip, there's 3 spaces in the car. You can take friends, family, celebrities. Who would you take with you? They can be dead or alive, but it gets to know you just that little bit. Well, a little bit more than just swimming.
3 people. Okay, let's go Whitney Houston, so she can sing us along.
Nice.
That's cartoon sorted. Dead or alive. Think of something, Alice. the comedian Robin Williams.
Oh yeah.
Very good, yeah.
Like him. He's good. Yeah. You can have the laughs. And then
Dan doesn't make the list.
I know, I was thinking Dan, but he's probably, I don't know. Well, go on then, I better put Dan in there, keep him happy. Although he won't like Whitney Houston on the front, so, you know.
Would he not?
Go on, put Dan
in. Oh, well, Alice, thank you so much for coming on to this week's episode of the Propulsion Swimming Podcast. It's been really great chatting to you, and best of luck with coaching in the near future, and hopefully we catch up on a poolside in Wales again very soon.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you for the story, and yeah, like Scott said, good luck with the coaching, and hopefully you don't get in the way of the Swansea Summers too much, you know? Yeah. But thank you for coming on. Thank you very much.
So Dan, brilliant to speak to one of Wales's finest ever swimmers and hear what is, I'd say it's still quite an emotional journey out of the sport because it was taken out of her hands. You can see she's still struggling to look back on her career at this point. She left the sport about, 3 months ago now? 3-4 months? So it's still very raw. And that's plainly obvious when she's talking about achievements like going to Tokyo and Commonwealth Games, and she's not actually reflected on any of that yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's so difficult when you're... She wanted to carry on. She wanted... The aim was Paris.
100%.
And the fact that she was forced out of the sport, she did everything she could to stay within the sport. I mean, we were talking about the steroid injections and the surgeries, and she did everything she possibly could. Land training, change of exercises, like the wrist placement and all that sort of stuff. And the fact that she couldn't really do turns properly. She did everything she could, and it just got to a point where, effectively, it was going to just break, and it just would never recover to what it could be now. I mean, she couldn't even lift up her cup of tea. That's how bad it was. I mean, the fact that her catch couldn't be in the right place, and it was slipping too much, and then it was a domino effect. I remember we were saying it's like a domino effect.
Yeah, it's a domino injuries.
The shoulder started becoming a problem, and then because you couldn't put too much pressure on the bad wrist, the other wrist got the full brunt of the force.
Yep.
A terrible position, but it's great that she's staying involved in the sports with her coaching position that she's got now. She's getting support from Swim Wales, which is amazing to hear, and I'd like to see that more from not just Swim Wales, but other governing bodies as well, because it's a tough road after training and being on a regimented routine and schedule to then suddenly have nothing. And it is quite raw for Alice, I think, at the moment. I did struggle with it, and it took me, can't remember exactly how long, but it did take me 6 to 12 months, I would say, to be right, I'm actually out of swimming, I can almost do what I want. But the problem is choice, and that's what I found really hard. And like I said on the podcast, 1 o'clock was always lunchtime, and now I'm like, well, I can actually eat when I want, you know. So
it's so like funny if when you compare kind of your swimming regiment to prison, it kind of does compare when you say it like that, with that you have to eat now at 1 o'clock. But that's a conversation for a completely different podcast in the future. I think I'd leave this podcast by saying I hope Alice is able to get in the water recreationally and kind of find an enjoyment for just going up and down. I know, to be fair, it took me probably 5-6 years to understand that that can still be enjoyable, even if you're not racing. But it's just going to take time. And hopefully the coaching, like you said, fills that transition period and is the best course of action for her.
Yeah, I mean, we'll just see how it goes for her. But I know that she even said that there's no point being involved in the elite scene if you can't put 100% into it and do what you want to do. And she can't do that. But we've both found a love for swimming outside of the competitive sort of arena and doing sort of like Great North swims and stuff like that, you know, and just doing our own public swimming. So she will eventually find that. It might just take a bit of time. But I think the coaching route is a good route to go down, because then she can still be having the social side of things with the Swansea Swimmers and, you know, and stuff like that with the coaches that she still talks to on a regular basis. So I think it will take time, as all things do.
And she gets the joy of writing her boyfriend Dan Jones his sets, which is always going to be a fun experience in the household. So that just about rounds up this week's episode of the Propulsion Swimming Podcast. If you haven't subscribed already, please do so on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. There's loads of new content coming soon, especially over on the YouTube channel. But until then, me and Dan will see you in 7 days' time.
Yeah, thank you for listening, everyone, and we'll catch you on the next one.
You've been listening to the Propulsion Swimming Podcast with Scott and Dan. We want to thank you for joining us and invite you to subscribe to the show, as well as checking out the Propulsion Swimming YouTube channel for weekly tutorials and videos to get your swimming fix. We will be back next week. Until then, we'll catch you on the next one.